Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is Wednesday, May 7th. We have Peter Buchvar and Ira Harris. Peter is Chief Investment Officer for the Bleakley Financial Group and Advisory at Bleakley. He has a newsletter product called The Book Report, which is on his Substack. It offers great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. And Ira is an independent trader, past hedge fund manager, and global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and a stint also there most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Richard, Ira, good to see you guys.
Yep. Yeah, great. Great to see you, Peter. Richard, we meet again.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. And just wanted to get your thoughts, Peter, on the global macro, on the economy and the financial markets.
It certainly is somewhat confusing and cloudy, I have to say. Excuse my congested sound. I've been nursing a cold for the past week. I think before the tariffs, we started to notice a bit of a shift in markets, and then I'll shift to the economy. I think the DeepSeek news at the end of January was a shot out of nowhere. In terms of making investors sort of reassess this Mag7 AI tech trade that's been so extraordinary for the last couple of years. And I thought at the time that maybe this is sort of the bell ringing on that trade and the bell ringing on the dominance of these stocks in terms of their ability to be the leadership group. And I think since then, that belief, I think, has been coming to fruition. Because a lot of the individual companies, some better than others, are dealing with their own fundamental challenges, and that maybe we are on the cusp of a major leadership change after many, many years of money piling into these stocks to the point where they became 35% of the S&P. My point is that this started before the tariffs came along. Then, of course, there was a big focus on government spending. Government spending has been, and to my point, AI has been one of the three drivers of economic growth, anything related to AI capital spending, in addition to upper income consumer spending and government spending. Now, on the government spending side, with Doge and Elon Musk and the new administration, we know that there was a big focus on not only existing government spending, but Scott Bessent talking about a detox that's needed in terms of the economy's reliance on excessive government spending and wanting to shift that spend and that focus to more of the private sector. Well, that's good. I like that focus for the credibility of the U.S. government's financial condition with $2 trillion deficits at 7% of GDP. This needed to happen, but there's implications to that in the short term in terms of government influence on growth. If every dollar that's spent by the government is a dollar that ends up in the private sector, if the government is contributing less on a per GDP basis or per capita basis, well, that means slower economic growth in the meantime until it can get better absorbed in the private sector. And then, of course, you throw on the tariffs, which I'm not a fan of. And I think that has frozen economic activity around the world in terms of manufacturing goods and supply chains and shipments and transportation of all sorts. And while we're taping this in the day that we've come to seem like a letter of intent, because it's not a signed deal, a letter of intent on a trade deal with the UK, I have to go through the details. I mean, we're going to be hopefully selling some more stuff to them, lowering some barriers and tariff rates, but we're still left with the 10% baseline tariff rate. And I think Trump, in his press conference in the Oval Office talking about it, did imply that 10% would sort of be the minimum tariff on countries that we're negotiating with the possibility that it's higher for others. So we're in a much higher tariff regime during this administration. And I think that's a negative for economic activity. Now, can it be offset by deregulation? That's what the bull case is, and extending the Trump tax cuts and maybe throwing in a few more tax cuts on overtime and Social Security and tips and so on. We'll see. I don't think so. I think deregulation is what they should have focused on. I think they should have focused on cutting the corporate income tax rate even further, because that's how you make the U.S. more competitive, not by raising the costs of doing business to your competitors and to yourself. That's my own quote-unquote political opinion. I'm more in the Rand Paul political dynamic when it comes to trade and free trade. And I understand all the worries about the cheating and the stealing of IP that China does. And I know it firsthand that it takes place. And but, you know, life is not fair. Trade barriers are unfair. We have our own trade barriers. Every country's got their own regulatory rules. Every country has their own needs that they find important. They favor some sectors. We favor others. You know, the U.S. government essentially is financing the U.S. housing market. You know, we all have our thing. But to basically put a halt on global trade in order to achieve some goals, I think was a dangerous game. You know, we have the 2018 experience with tariffs, and unfortunately, no one is going back to that time frame to say, okay, well, this was tried previously, not too long ago. What were the results? Well, the results were U.S. manufacturing went into recession and the Fed was cutting interest rates in 2019. And is our U.S. steel and aluminum industries any better off today after those tariffs? Well, I would argue no. And what we did was just, we then ramped up the tariffs even more, thinking that we're going to somehow get a different outcome. So this is what has me worried. So you have the loss of the AI tech trade, which makes the stock market more vulnerable, unless it can pass the baton quickly on to some other leadership group, which I think it's maybe trying to, but maybe actually more so with international markets. I'm sure we'll get to that, which I'm more bullish on than the US right now. Losing potentially the AI tech trade if the capital spending rates, which are still pretty robust. A lot of the companies in their first quarter earnings releases confirmed it, but there's no incremental increase. It's just very high levels. So on a rate of change basis, it's actually beginning to slow. And then where government spending lays out, we'll see what the budget bill ends up being, how the tax cuts get extended. But unfortunately, I think with the tax cuts at best, they're just, the existing rates are going to get extended. So we're not necessarily going to get that big incremental lift on the tax cutting side. So I'm worried for growth, whether we get a recession or not, I don't know. But I think the risks are rising. And I will say, though, if the stock market does roll over again, and I emphasize if, because who knows if it'll happen, that will probably clinch a recession, because that will then negatively impact upper income spending.
Well, great. That's a great overview. And I agree with everything you said. Also, thanks for pointing out the 2018 experience, because I think it's important to realize it took a long time, like 6 to 12 months at least, right, to finalize the deal. As you mentioned, it's just a letter of intent today with one country. So that time frame may factor in as well, negatively, adversely on the U.S. economy in the meantime. Your thoughts, Ira?
No, I there's no reason to be redundant. And I think that bringing up 2018 is important. And I'm looking at it as a very critical moment, because during Bessent's confirmation hearing, he got asked that question about the 2018, especially with the ag agreement with China. And it was asked by Todd Young of Indiana, senator from Indiana, who said, number one, because he wanted the ag agreement and it was never fulfilled for whatever reasons. So I'm watching right now, again, because if it'll be a huge indicator, if there's really something that's really negotiating rather than just people yelling at each other. And if there's an ag agreement, U.S. ag products should rise. Well, global Well, it won't affect as much global, but U.S. ag, especially if you watch wheat, corn, beans, and all the sidelines, they should have a fairly sizable rally because, and especially this administration. And if Peter Bessent is the deficit hawk that he portends to be, he should be pushing this rather than the first response was, hey, the ag sector is getting hurt. We need a subsidy package, right? Well, if you're looking to rein in deficits, you're not looking to just throw more money over to solve problems. You need to solve the problems in other ways. And the other way would be actually negotiating something and to get U.S. ag products, especially into Europe, too. Because, you know, France, the common agricultural, the CAP of the EU is all about France and a couple of large other agricultural nations protecting those borders, probably as close to the corn laws as we've seen, but that's the way it was to placate the French. So there'd have to be some break on there, but that's a win-win for China. China always needs food, and whether they buy it from Brazil or from the United States, and that's to me where Navarro screwed the American farmers in 2018, because again, as a linear thinker, well, we're going to put these on and this is going to be the effect. No. Because when did they do it? In March of 2018, with the tariffs, the Brazilian soybean crop was just coming in, as well as corn, and there was a plentiful other supplier. It's like declaring air traffic control strike during August when nobody was flying back in 1980-81. You want to call that strike around Thanksgiving or Christmas, when you're really, you know, because that's the power of a strike to affect as much people. It's this problem when you want to do these. You don't want to harm yourself, as Peter talked. Why keep shooting yourself in the foot? So I just keep looking for these things that will be indicators. And today we had one other that I'm looking for as an indicator. And that, of course, would be the Nippon Steel purchase of U.S. Steel. And Biden and Trump both phenomenally stupid in that regard, bipartisan stupidity. That seems to be a bipartisan thing that they all celebrate, which talked about Cleveland Cliffs buying U.S. Steel. Well, Cleveland Cliffs report came out today. The stock is down substantially, but more importantly, they're closing 7 plants. Is this who I want running U.S. Steel, or do I want Nippon, which is a high quality manufacturer who is far above the rest of them, is a much better green producer because of what they use in their furnaces. So this is a layup deal. So that's one I'm watching too, because if there's any movement on that deal where they would allow the Nippon Steel to take over U.S. Steel, I would think we'd get other movements on this tariff. So I keep looking for other barometers, which I'm paying attention to.
And a follow-up on the questions for the U.K. negotiations deal for the trade tariffs. Peter, a couple of questions. Do you think it will include a revaluation higher of the trading partner currency? So this is a general question, not just for UK, but like especially the Asia trading partners. Will it necessarily include a revaluation higher of the trading partner currency, a de facto Plaza Accord 2, if you will? And will it also include a restriction or prohibition on trading with China?
I think no and no on my answers to that. I don't think that we're going to be able to get away with wanting to devalue the dollar as part of this, because we just slapped a 10% tariff minimum on everybody. And theoretically, you want the US dollar to actually strengthen by a similar amount to mitigate that cost increase. So maybe at some point you want a weaker dollar, even though I'm not a fan of manipulating one's currency to try to get some outcome. I prefer more stable currencies, but I don't think they're going to be able to pull off some broad currency negotiation because I don't think other countries are going to want to stand for a dramatic rise in their currencies. Now, with China, I don't think we're going to be able to get away with it. First of all, strategically, I think it's kind of stupid to try to split up the world, particularly when China and the US make up about half of the world's global GDP. And all you would do is make everyone poorer rather than making us richer. So I don't think that that's part of the negotiation. I do think, though, that that's the negotiation elephant in the room. You know, we can have a nice little trade deal with the UK, and they can buy more Boeing planes, and, you know, we can sell some more soybeans to them. But, you know, the real big trading negotiation has to take place with China because of the heavy reliance that both of us have. Now, to me, there's very simplistic thinking that, oh, just because we have a bigger deficit than they do, they're more reliant on us. The problem is that the things that we're reliant on them for, we can't necessarily get somewhere else. They have the rest of the world to sell stuff to. You know, the US is about a quarter of the world's GDP, and we only make up 4% of the world's population. So if we keep this up over time, China's going to find a lot of other customers to sell to and become less reliant on us, while it's going to take many, many years for us to sort of recreate the supply chains that we've created in China. And again, I understand the issues that people have with China. I do think, though, it's with some people, it's China derangement syndrome, everything clouds their thinking. And I understand the IP theft and these things, but I just think that there was a much better way of going about dealing with China than, you know, putting out of business a lot of small companies in the US that can't quickly shift supply chains as well and as agile as maybe bigger companies can.
Yeah, great points, Peter. And Ira, what are your thoughts? I know we've exchanged a few emails on like the Taiwan dollar, the Korean won getting stronger in the last few weeks. What are your thoughts on the revaluation as part of the trading negotiations and the potential restriction or prohibition on trading with China?
Well, you know, Peter and I will diverge here because I think that a weaker dollar could do a lot to lighten the load of tariffs because, first of all, it can take over play over time. I can get a 10 to 15% downward move in the dollar. And I'm just speaking theoretically. And it won't impact inflation to the extent that people think it's going to impact because it'll be over time and there's an adjustment. And a lot of foreign producers will eat that as long as it's a slow process. We've seen that. The Japanese do it. The Chinese do it. But we've seen this movement in the Taiwan dollar. Now, why? Everybody was speculating why. This morning, the South China Morning Post, Nick Sparrow, I think that's his name, and I thought it made perfect sense because the Chinese, a lot of Taiwan insurance companies were caught off here and got fearful. Same as we saw on August 5th, by the way, when the yen carry trade got unwound because people were getting a little bit nervous. And you saw that dramatic move. And then, of course, it retraced itself. There was nothing sustaining it. We didn't get any cut from the Fed on the July 31st meeting, even though Peter and I both thought that the Fed ought to have cut, and I think we talked about it. They didn't. So it was just an unwinding of the carry trade. Is this what's going on with Taiwan? Could be. But I'll tell you what, the more interesting chart to me is the Singapore dollar. The Singapore dollar has been rallying, meaning the US dollar has been falling against the Sing dollar. So there's definitely some switches. Now, you know, and my sense would be that I point my finger at Ueda, I think he's really dropped the ball here, but I can't just blame him because the Ministry of Finance, the concept of the BOJ being independent, that's a historical farce, by the way, because when the Japanese government wants certain actions, they'll get certain actions, regardless of what the bank may want. They'll control it through the Ministry of Finance. But why, if you're in negotiations, wouldn't you try to at least create some situation where your currency is strengthening, and then you could say to the U.S. administration, look, we understand that there are imbalances, but we're trying to correct them through our currency strengthen it, even though you come back and say, look, at the yen was at 80 yen to the dollar 12, 13 years ago, and you still ran surpluses. But a lot of those were based on Japanese multinationals, and they had gone to China, they'd gone to Vietnam, they'd gone to Thailand, is because the yen was so strong. So there is some modicum here. But why wouldn't you want to push your currency a little bit higher to show that, hey, there's some, faith here, and we're trying to. Now, on the other hand, you get the carry trade. And if everybody's pumping their money, they're taking their recycled surpluses and buying them back to the U.S. bond market, the dollar can't come down. It's one of those things that we're caught on. That's the true dilemma. We can call it Triffin's dilemma. We can go other places. But that's the existence that we have. And that perpetuates, if you're concerned about the deficit, concerned about the trade deficit is, only looking at one side, of course, of any ledger, because the current account. Now, the current account is very significant, but as Peter talks about, and right, very regularly he talks about it, with the reinvestment of money, foreign direct investment into the U.S., or the U.S. investment flows out to other countries and the flows back, that's pretty substantial. That's where we make it back in services, and there's a huge flow of that. If that were to end because people got tired of the antics, that would be a devastating factor. I'll stop. Peter wants to say something. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it's with respect to sort of weaving in currency movements with trade deals, it's, the currency markets may not go the way that you want it to in terms of direction, as long as they free float. And one of the issues with the U.S. is that about 40% of our imports of goods, about 40% of our imports are goods are intermediate term goods. They're not finished products. Yeah. So if you weaken the dollar too much, you're raising the input costs of a lot of U.S. manufacturers that end up in that finished product. So there are a lot of gives and takes. Now, on that eventual finished product that is then sold overseas, well, then you have a competitive benefit by having that weaker currency. But I just think there are a lot of sort of pushes and pulls, and we can theorize about what the right currency rate is. I just think that the currency markets, and Ira knows this as well as anybody, the $7 trillion, $8 trillion of foreign currencies that are traded every day, your currency doesn't necessarily go to where you want it to go. And, one's great plans, like Mike Tyson said, could get disrupted, just as a lot of the trade people in the new administration thought, we'll put the tariffs on, or the dollar will strengthen, and that'll mitigate the impact on us from tariffs. The exact opposite has happened. And that's just my thought on that.
And I certainly agree with that, which is more importantly why the president needs to stay quiet. Because the more he talks him up, the more he gives Powell an argument that allows him to do nothing. And everybody around us is cutting interest rates. This is a real problem. Everybody's cutting. So if there's a carry trade, and I don't believe, never have, carry trade is it's probably one of the weakest fundamentals for driving currencies. When currencies, go a bit back, let's go back to Keynes. If the currencies were really allowed to correct the imbalances to correct, if you're totally relying, usually if you're raising rates and you have to keep raising rates, let's go back to Britain in 1992. If you have to raise rates to protect a currency, you're in very thin ice, by the way. That's a very momentary, that's a very temporal effect.
That's third world-like.
It is very third world-like. Yeah. And if Trump would not talk about tariffs, Powell could follow that line down. And like the ECB, today the Bank of England cut, right? And there were two votes who wanted to cut 50 basis points. We had the ECB cut last week. And yet those currencies, the British pound was down minimis. So that would give, that would take away Powell's rationale because of the uncertainty from tariffs, the uncertainty. And I'm not saying that you don't, the tariffs don't exist. Just lower the conversation, lower the temperature on the conversation so that you could actually work. And rather than it, and you would remove that leg out from under Powell, because again, the Chinese cut yesterday, the Brits cut today, the Swiss cut, inverse of that is that Japan doesn't raise, and Japan ought to be raising, is because as Peter talks about, what the effect on the U.S. with the intermediate goods, that has been a negative effect on Japan. In fact, again, I'll stress, it brought Ishiba into power because the middle class in Japan is very upset because the weak yen has really affected them in a negative basis because, you know, Japan imports so much stuff that those prices have gone up. So if Ueda was doing what Ueda ought to do, again, removed it, but if we take the tariffs out of discussion and would raise rates, the yen would go higher and it would mitigate some of the inflationary impact. You know, we're really talking about, and the whole world, all these rate cuts, this is all about real yields anyway. So if I wanted to weaken my currency, weaken the real yields. And that's what Trump, without saying it, because he doesn't know, I'm sorry to be so blunt, he doesn't know jack shit about interest rates, nor how the market really works, except he knows how to borrow money and then hire lawyers to prevent it from being repaid. And that's not a political statement whatsoever. That's just reality. The way that the interest rate market is, if you would stop talking about that, you would remove one of those legs and you may be able to get that which you want.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
I think Ira's making a really important point with the current policy sort of handcuffing the Fed's ability to react. You know, that's the thing is that we're self-imposing this economic weakness that would potentially trigger a rate cut, but other countries worried about that economic growth are cutting interest rates. And part of the reason why they have some flexibility to do that is because the bounce in their currencies help to mitigate some of the inflation risks that they potentially will incur via these tariffs. But also, you know, Powell and Trump obviously don't like each other. We hear that every day with the name calling that Trump has of Powell. The latest one was Powell's now a fool. He was a stiff and he was, you know, a laundry list of names. And not that I think that Powell will let that prevent him from doing what he thinks he needs to do, but it doesn't help the situation. Because if he does cut, then the argument can be made he's caving to Trump and political pressure. And if he does not, he can say, well, Powell is stiff-arming Trump and not going to give in to what he wants. So it's almost this no-win situation that gets created. But at the end of the day, the market's still pricing in three cuts. And maybe they'll get it, maybe they won't. I do think as much as Powell likes to say, and I believe this thought, that you need stable prices in order to have a healthy labor market, I'm sure the political pressure will get intense if the unemployment rate went north of 4.5%, approached 5% in the next, call it 3 months, 6 months. then they will definitely be cutting in response to that. But then take it a step further is, will the market response to rate cuts be similar to what we've seen in the past, where yields fall across the curve, stock markets rally, everything is fine, the economy stabilizes, or is the long end going to speak up on its own and say, well, I don't think the Fed should be cutting interest rates in this stagflationary environment, and long rates go up and the 10-year approaches 5%, or the dollar really breaks down if the Fed starts to cut interest rates, and maybe the dollar index is 90 instead of 100, and oil is at 90 instead of 70, or 65, we're at 60 now as it is as we stand here. So I think there are a lot of potential consequences to, okay, let's just cut rates and everything will be fine. We're in a much different dynamic, I believe, than the license the Fed had to do whatever they wanted pre-2022 when inflation was low. We're just not in that world anymore. And I think the after effects of what they can do in any direction is much different than what we're used to.
If I can add because I think Peter goes on, and I'll be a little more forthright in saying this, that Bissent's strength is that he could look at Trump and go, if you want to keep playing this, I'm out of here. If Bissent walks out of that position, the long end will go to 6.5%. That's what I believe. Because who are you going to hire? Are you not going to hire? Kevin Warsh wouldn't take the secretary job. Because if you think that Bissent is tough to deal with, Kevin Warsh has laid the groundwork he's no pushover. He didn't get pushed over by when he was a governor on the Fed in 2011-12 with QE, when he was opposed it and openly opposed Bernanke, which is why I believe that Warsh wasn't picked in 2017, by the way, because you will not roll over Kevin Warsh. So Bissent's strength is, hey, you want to push at me? If I walk out of here, right now the bond markets, and I agree with it, we're sitting here very carefully because people just don't know. And again, all the stuff that's going on, they're not making any headway on the deficit. As I pointed out, what was the first thing that they were going to do with the pain and suffering of the ag sector was offer a package, a support package. Again, more spending. They have, we hear about the Doge cuts, and I'm sure that they were successful in doing some, and I applaud that. But they're not anywhere near where they purportedly to go. The only thing good we can say is that thank God it's not the Kamala team or whatever team it was, because then we wouldn't even be having these discussions and everything would just be going on, and we would be probably talking about just tax hikes to solve every problem on that end. So if Bissent, to me, that's one of those things that I'm looking for. It's one of those barometers in the room. If Bissent were to pick up and leave tomorrow, I think the markets would really struggle in a big way. I think that's, Bissent needs that to use that in his inner circle bargaining chip.
You're going to say something, Peter, or?
No. I don't know whether I was referring to Powell or Bessent about leaving.
Oh, Powell, I don't care about.
Oh, yeah, Bessent, right.
It's Bessent. I don't think Powell would have a damn thing to do with the bond markets, except, maybe to do more QE, because what can the, or raise rates. And I don't see the Fed raising rates. People who say that, it was a question yesterday to Powell, amongst all the other named questions. I keep waiting for somebody to ask Powell about the gold market. Does it send you a signal that makes you nervous? It's like it exists, but that's a...
We need Ron Paul back to ask that question.
Yeah, we sure do.
Okay, speaking of cutting interest rates, do you see, Peter, an emerging trend on where we have days the U.S. bonds down, U.S. equities down, and U.S. dollar down on the same day at the same time, notwithstanding today, not really happening today, but in the last 2 or 3 weeks, we've seen several days like that. And it could be exacerbated with cutting rates with an even further fall in the dollar. What do you make of that? Is that an indication of capital flight? out of the U.S., like Mag 7 selling, U.S. Treasury bonds selling. What are your thoughts?
You know, that we definitely had some days of that for sure. And it got to the point where one of those days resulted in the 90-day pause in the reciprocal tariffs. Will we see more of those days? I think very likely. The most interesting data points that I'm now awaiting are the refreshed 13 DNFs from on a lot of different publicly traded stocks. The last ones we have are as of December 31st, where we saw what I thought was peak foreign ownership of U.S. stocks. And I want to see to what extent, as of March 31st, those holdings have been reduced. And likely after Liberation Day in April, they were probably further reduced. And I say that because as of December 31st, foreigners owned an enormous amount of U.S. stocks. They owned almost $20 trillion worth. The number was about $18 trillion. And some of the big foreign holders were central banks. And some of them were the biggest holders of U.S. technology stocks. And the Norwegian central bank's investment arm, their top 10 holdings included the Mag 7. They were the 10th largest shareholder of NVIDIA as of December 31st. The Swiss National Bank owned 90 million shares of NVIDIA. So these stocks became a reserve asset. And I have to believe that their holdings are going to be less than what they were at the beginning of the year. And it'll be good to see to what extent. And I think just overall, there's just a general rethink of the foreign attitudes towards investing in the U.S. Well, we've already seen, at least from Canada and Europe, a rethink on traveling to the U.S. But you would have to think that investors are now thinking about other things to buy. Because, and it gets to my original point, if the U.S. stock market also is losing the Mag 7 as a leadership group, well, investors are also going to find other things to buy. And if the dollar continues to weaken, well, maybe they'll just find other markets to buy stocks in where they don't have to worry about losing value via the weaker dollar, because that's the one thing that they have to focus on. If they're not going to hedge their U.S. dollar exposure and they're worried about U.S. dollar weakness, they'll be less inclined to further incrementally invest in U.S. assets. And if anything, continue to sell U.S. assets so they don't keep getting clipped by a weaker dollar. So that is an important flow through of the currency, the stock market, and certainly the treasury market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great points. And I'd like to get in on your thoughts after this on the international markets. But first, your thoughts, Ira, on this?
Peter says a lot here, and it's in those days where we've had those. But I would argue, going back to what talked about before with Bessent, it starts with the bond markets, because the bond markets were reacting in ways that we don't see. So the bonds, those yields went up, didn't draw the dollar. It was a signal that the dollar was really struggling, that people were looking at, as Peter talked about, and the equity markets. And they, I mean, so all those, again, just like with the German market on the day when the Germany announced that massive stimulus program, the DAX, which is, by the way, making all-time highs this week, so we have strength again, quietly, because it's not doing it on the announcements. In fact, it overcame the politics, because there was a signal sent to MERS, to Frederick and Ethel Mertz on Tuesday, and he got the message. But and the DAX has since gone in the futures market anyway. It made all-time highs today, so it's moving up. But when it did that, it was such an anomalous situation, as Peter talks about. Bonds down, dollar down, stocks down, and not just a little bit on all of those, pretty dynamically, sent the message that, what are you guys doing? You know, this isn't negotiation. This is just, you know, chainsaw massacres, you know, and you're going to pay a price. And that's my point about the bonds, that if Bessent walks out the door and the bond yields go higher because nobody has any faith in who's coming here, and Congress hasn't done anything, and right now, you know, the Republicans in Congress, you know, it's amazing. They must drink from the same water fountain as the Democrats, because it's It doesn't help any gray matter grow. So they can't get anywhere. And the budget that I just saw with a 23% increase in defense spending, are you kidding me? That ought to be the first thing that they're cutting. And that's where the Democrats, to me, dropped the ball. Why didn't you go after defense funding? And again, it's all been there. You're not breaking new ground. I saw Krugman's piece the other day, and all he cited was the Grace Commission under Reagan and Doge now. But he conveniently left out. And that's why his credibility is lacking when he writes his, as a public intellectual. I'm not talking about his ability as an economist. I have a lot of respect for that. But he conveniently left out the Bowles-Simpson group, which was an Obama concoction. And their first thing with Alan Simpson, and you can go look it up, go to Copilot and ask, they were cutting 10% out of the defense budget. And everybody got cold feet. They didn't want, go after the defense budget. Why are you raising defense spending here? You've got plenty. You just have to reorient it.
And I think the level it was raised was higher than the Doge savings, I think. Yeah. But So international markets, Peter, what are your thoughts? Which markets do you like? Is it like Brazil or Asia Pacific region? What do you make of China? Also, is China investable for a G7 investor?
I think what all of the above is how I've been positioned. I mean, there are a couple things here. One of the interesting dynamics between international markets relative to the U.S. is higher dividend yields. The U.S., the S&P 500 dividend yield is about 1.3%, I think, maybe 1.4%, where in Europe, it's common to find 3, 4, 5% dividend yields in a much more robust way. Now, you can find, of course, higher dividend paying stocks in the U.S., whether it's REITs, utilities, consumer products companies, but it's much more widespread, particularly in Europe and also in Asia. And these stocks really have been left for dead. I mean, I can't emphasize enough how much sort of stock market oxygen out of the global room that the U.S. took, driven by the market cap increases in these big technology companies that were so extraordinary. And I do think that we're getting some mean reversion. The pendulum is now swinging in the other direction, and people are realizing and waking up to the fact that, you can get by a lot of stocks in Europe and Asia with low to mid-teens multiples and 3, 4, 5% dividend yields. And, that's pretty attractive right now. And then, of course, if you get some currency increase with a weaker dollar, then that further enhances your return. And so I do think that this is more than just a 1 to 2 quarter thing. I think this is potentially a multi-year transition that's taking place. I mean, the U.S. stock market as a percentage of global market cap just got to historic highs. And we're going to see, like I said, just the pendulum beginning to swing in the other direction. And over time, U.S. companies will still be dominant around the world. The U.S. economy will still be a dominant force. So I'm really more talking about, the ability of the stock market that has already priced in, at least for now, a lot of that to sort of diversify into other things. But I do want to emphasize, though, a point I made earlier, we cannot take trade with the rest of the world for granted, which I'm afraid that we are. We're thinking that we're the only big house in the neighborhood, but about 75% of the world's GDP takes place outside the U.S. That percentage is only going to grow over the coming decades. 96% of the world's population lives outside the U.S. That means 96% of the world's potential customers live outside the U.S. We can't take that opportunity for granted. Because one of the things, and to get back to the tariff thing, is that Peter Navarro basically revealed what, in his ideal world, what it would look like. And that would be a U.S. car manufacturer, to use this as an example, because this is the example he gave, is to be completely vertically integrated, is to build the transmission, build the tires, build the engine, and assemble the car. So do everything here, which sounds all well and good, but on a cost efficiency basis, it's wholly unrealistic because the end price of that car will maybe be afforded by somebody in the U.S., but a big chunk of U.S. consumers will not be able to pay for that car, and that U.S. manufacturer will lose access to global markets. So the U.S. car company that builds the car in the way that Pininfarina Navara wants to build it, well, if they want to sell cars in Europe, they're just going to open up a factory in Europe and source parts from Mexico or Canada and other places to build that car in Europe for European customers and for other customers. So we will then have no exports out of the U.S. if Pininfarina Navara gets the perfect world that he thinks we should have.
Wow, yeah, great points. Your thoughts, Ira?
The dangers of linear thinking in a nonlinear world, and politics, you can plot this all out. But as Mike Every and others have talked about, statecraft and everything that plays in it, it does. And you don't want to live in that. If you want to just isolate yourself, we saw that didn't work, because the isolationists rose in 1919, 1920, 1921, after the horrors of World War I. And that just got us World War II faster, probably. So you can insulate. It's all about adaptability. It's not just saying this, and the world was adapting. It adapted in a way where the pendulum went this too far. And that's why Trump got elected. So you got to give him that, because it was that group of people who had been left behind, who were promised that they'd be supported by, remember, I can remember the Rust Belt, as the Rust Belt was decaying in the 80s and 90s, and all the promises of all these programs to help reorient to new jobs, which never got funded to the extent that they should have, and they got left behind because, once the money started flowing, everybody forgot about it. But I understand the pendulum swung, and it swung hard. And as usual, when the pendulum swung, heads get knocked off. And that's not to make light out of it. They're because we're in this situation and talking, having these discussions now, only because of that. And that's a good thing, because it wakes you up to it. Now it's in the adjustment process. But to say is, and I think that Peter's point that Navarro makes, and I'll call him Navarro because I don't want to denigrate the name. So is that, you think the world's just not going to break down like that, and I'm not talking about Adam Smith or Ricardian comparative advantage. I'm just finding that there are ways you're going to have to live in this world. You're going to have to get your lithium batteries here. You're going to have to get this here. You're going to have to, these people may be better at making this. There's no way around it. It's just that it doesn't have to be an all or none either way. And I think that some people would say that the way that we've dealt with the world, especially since Clinton went to Beijing in 1998, and of course the WTO, and is that it was an all or none that way. But of course it wasn't all or none. China was busy buying stuff from the United States until we cut some of that off, because we didn't want our quote unquote enemy to have access to the highest technological aspect to catch up quicker. And yeah, I'm not naive. I understand that they steal intellectual property. They're not the only ones. Don't forget, the United States was built on the theft of intellectual property called power looms by a guy named Sam Slater in 1790s, because he took all the plants and plans from Britain and brought them to the United States. This goes on. How do you deal with it? That's the issue. There's always going to be intellectual property theft. Always. So you can't be naive. Oh, we're going to wait. No. So everything that Peter says, I agree with, and there's the internet, and we talk about. And I think if you've listened to Peter and I and a few others who've been on these podcasts over the last 4 years, there's been a lot of high-quality stocks with global roots that have been very good. They're not NVIDIA. If you only focus on NVIDIA, but Peter's talked about the cow. If you would have done with Wynn, very nice. We've talked about foreign banks. We've talked about them with fiber. There's been ad companies, mining companies, things that have really done. So Peter's right on target. Now you got to really roll up your sleeves and get to work. And I'm not touting, we can talk about these in a top-down manner. And that's how we're talking about it. You find your ways to them. I can remember we talked Kansas Southern, which got bought out. And instead of it, I couldn't believe that Buffett never bought it. That's one that always scratched me. Now there's mining companies that I think are phenomenally cheap. Now, you can say they ought to be cheap, but sometimes in today's world with high-speed financial shifting, things get cheap because they're just not getting covered by the mass media, so you don't see that. And you can, and who's sitting out on U.S. stocks right now, but actually buying a lot of foreign, buying more foreign, is Buffett. And you, and I remember in 98 and 99, CNBC couldn't make enough fun of Buffett for not being in the dot-com revolution, right?
Right.
You know, patience is a virtue, especially when it comes to investing. You don't have to, I know that the rewards in a high-speed communication world, but Buffett did pretty well for somebody who missed the dot-com boom. And they would pick on him and pick on him because, you know, Berkshire so underperformed. But it wasn't too much longer that Berkshire spent a lot of years outperforming everybody else and was grabbing cheap assets. So that's what we're looking for, cheap assets relative to their underlying good values and their ability to have staying power. And I think really, if you go back through 4 years of these podcasts, you might be amazed at things that we talked about, not touted, because there's no touting that goes on here. There's just discussion of what possibly from a top-down perspective makes its way out there.
Wow, yeah, that's great points, Ira. And what about your thoughts, Peter, on the commodity sector, gold, precious metals? I know you've liked fertilizer, agricultural commodities you've mentioned in the past, copper. Your thoughts there?
So on the commodity space, I've been very bullish on precious metals for years now, gold and silver, and I remain so, particularly people realizing that gold is probably the key reserve asset that central banks want to own right now, and certainly less dollars relative to their sort of reserve pie. And we've recently, you know, going back last year, took a position in platinum. Yes, the ag space is more, you know, you have to more trade that. We were in it pre-Russian invasion of Ukraine. We were out of it after that spike in the names. And then last year when net short positions in corn and soybeans hit record highs on a non-spec basis, and these stocks had got cut in half, we revisited them. So we're long Nutrien and Mosaic, still bullish on uranium. And after the California fires, or the LA fires specifically, took a position in lumber via Weyerhaeuser. So believing that, and still bullish on oil and gas stocks, particularly natural gas. Now, obviously, oil has fallen a lot here, but you know, the stocks themselves have done, or at least the big cap names that were owned, were along the European ones like BP and Shell. BP has been a disaster, of course, but it's so bad, I think it's potentially good now with activists and potentially Shell now looking to take them over. You know, a lot of these companies have really focused on shareholder returns, cash flows, the ability to weather storms, not drilling for drilling's sake, focusing on debt reduction. And so they're much better run companies. And I think $60 oil is dirt cheap. And while OPEC and the Saudis have talked about and have implemented some production increases, I think you've basically now frozen out U.S. shale production. So you're going to get a lot of laid down rigs. And this is how low prices cure low prices. And but definitely more bullish on natural gas. But U.S. oil at $60 is pretty cheap, I believe.
And your thoughts, Ira, on the commodities?
Yeah, I'm good. Peter brought, yeah, that's right. Because we've gone, you know, between uranium, and we've talked about uranium, and we've talked, and Peter's, I'm his steadfastness with gold and silver has been quite dynamic over the years. I mean, the equity had performed miserably. There's no question about it. In fact, there was a discussion that took place. Supposedly, Buffett was buying Newmont. I don't know, you know, I checked with Copilot again. I'm really starting to, I don't like Gemini, but Copilot has been, and I asked a question, okay. Not sure if that's the case, because again, the gold miners have performed miserably. Now there's a reason they perform miserably, because at the bottom of the, at the end of the day, they're still companies. And if you're managing badly, they're going to perform. And especially when the underlying commodity price. So are there, you got to pay attention there. I'm not telling you, go do your homework, you know, and figure out where your risk tolerance was. You know, it must have been 8-9 months ago when Druckenmiller made the comment that he was acquiring Newmont and Barrick. They had a boost, you know. In fact, I grabbed Newmont at $31, $32, not just a small position because I was bullish gold, but the stocks were, and it had a big run up and then it came back down. So when big players get involved, but the underlying fundamentals don't seem to be good enough to drive these, but it's still, we got, as Peter talked about, the eggs, and egg prices have been under pressure. And yet, you know, they're not terribly, you know, Bunge still performs pretty well. Archer Daniels is just so badly managed, and they've made so many critical errors. That stock has been a weak, but Nutrien and Mosaic, and interestingly, that they hold in there pretty good, but they're still decent values at this time. And again, if the global economy gets its footing, these are going to be wonderful places to be. And we can go to, you know, Glencore has retraced almost all the move, you know, not quite, but certainly 60 or 70% of the move that it had put on. Same with Freeport, although Freeport's starting to pop a little bit. So they're out there. You got to do the work. And I think that one of the things that we bring to the table is putting together a global macro picture that says these are where things may be taking off. And again, the DAX made all-time highs this week. So amongst us, there's been good companies, you know, as I talked about with Nomi Prince, you know, and I think Peter would, ABB, the big European engineering company, it has attraction to me. Is it viable here? I don't know. It all depends upon your risk tolerance, but there are things to come. If there is any type of peace in the Ukraine, and I stress that if, I think they'll be a big beneficiary. They're also a beneficiary on the other side of the coin from the defense aspect of it. And Europe is going to ramp up their defense as well as infrastructure. So big engineering companies and material companies will partake in that. And you can see they're not happy with the U.S. right now. So who said that? I think Descent made that comment. No, maybe somebody else. That if you helped Russia, you will not get any of the benefits that will come from contracts to rebuild Ukraine. I'm not sure if it was Descent, so I'm not, but somebody did say that from the administration, and I thought that was interesting. So there are things to look around, and I still like European financials, because to me, Europe, Christine Lagarde, before she leaves, is going to try to push with Draghi for a capital markets union. And if that takes place, the whole structure of everything we look at with big banks, that's what I think the Italian banks are looking at. So there's these things that are out there. I'm still bullish Mitsubishi, Tokyo. I've talked about that. It's been a good play, but it's kind of settled in here as Japan's trying to figure out what they're going to do here. And there's others, you know, is throughout these podcasts that we've talked about. And for us, and I know Peter, because over the years, if I get bullish Europe, I know something's wrong with me. So, but when the sands shift, you better shift with them. Otherwise, you get, yeah, you know, you wind up in a quagmire drowning. So when and there are shifts taking place.
And Richard, you mentioned Brazil earlier. Brazil is, yes, a good way to also play the commodity space too.
Yeah, it's great opportunities there. Yes. And in Argentina as well, Colombia. Yeah. Well, it's been a great, insightful discussion. How can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work, Peter?
So my daily writings, I'm on Substack. You can type in my name, and it's titled The Book Report. And on the wealth management side, you can check out our website at bleakley.com.
Great. Thanks, and Ira.
Find me here. We're doing more of these. We've been doing them, and I love these because we, you know what, we get Peter out. I'm sorry he's not feeling well. We get him more animated. But these are great. And I read his every morning. It's my first read. I will tell you that. It's a concise summary. And him and I talked about something else that he has to do to let people know, but pay attention. You know what? There's a lot of nonsense out there. Peter, on a daily basis, first thing in the morning, takes care of a lot of nonsense and points you to the things that are predominant in the global markets. And we'll be on, continue to watch for any things we think will be indicators of sea changes taking place, because that's really what this is about. You want to change with them. So, and I love these. So.
Great.
Thanks, Ira. This was fun.
Yeah. Likewise. Thank you so much, Peter and Ira. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you, guys.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.